Accession number 9752, reel 13.
Colonel Dillon, reel 13. After the counterattack, which I presume was local, what happened then?
We gathered what tanks we could get together and withdrew them away from the enemy.
How did you disengage tanks in a circumstance like this? Because they were so slow moving and so prone to mechanical breakdown. That from a situation like that, where you just made a counterattack against an attacking enemy,
yes,
was it not difficult to get the tanks back out?
It was difficult for mechanical reasons. The tank crews themselves were only too anxious to get out, because they were in an exposed position with no support. There's no trouble about that. The trouble was those that couldn't get out but were left behind. And what happened then was that those tanks were destroyed, and the crews took the guns out and came back as infantry using their machine guns as little infantry detachments, still keeping more or less together.
Did you lose many tanks like that?
I forget the exact numbers, but I think about a third of the battalion was lost.
What happened to the rest of the tanks as they came back from this counterattack and continued the retreat?
They had various escapades. It was more or less a case of each man for himself. You can imagine there's a very considerable amount of confusion in the battle area at that time, and any tank that could get back got back as best he could. There's one case when a section commander was faced with a narrow canal, and the engineers are just going to blow up the bridge. As he got there, he had to fight for this chap to stop him blowing the bridge before he got the tanks across. And I had a sleepless 24 hours. I was 3 nights without any sleep, going round trying to find somebody who would give us a point to go to where we could assemble together and get into a coherent fighting force again. Every headquarters has disappeared. Eventually I found a very flustered and wearied staff captain who said he hadn't got a clue where his headquarters had gone to, and nobody knew anything. However, my colonel said, well, we'll make our own rallying point. So he set his set his course for this place called Wal Rabeh on the Amiens-Elbe Road, which was easy to find, a good road leading to it, and we managed one way or another to get all the tanks together there. I had just harking back to these penny packets to emerge as savage rabbits. I don't know if I've told this before, you can erase it if I have, but I had a motorbike and sidecar then. I'd become the battalion reconnaissance officer, and I went up to see this, to visit this section which was stuck and miles away from anybody, but quite near the Germans. When I came away, a German officer, I presume, was feeling idle and saw this motorbike and sidecar on a country road, and he started ranging on me, And he missed one or two, but the next thing I knew was that there was a crater right in the middle of the road, a narrow track, and completely obliterating the whole road. I was going fairly fast. There was only one thing to do, and that was to go for it as hard as I could. And I got to the edge of the crater, I leant over on the side of the bike, and that lifted the sidecar wheel in the air long enough for it to lump over the open space beneath and meet firm ground on the other side. And we got away with it. But it was a very nasty experience. Spiteful chap, you know, just to waste ammunition on one motorbike.
You say you are now a battalion reconnaissance officer. What extra responsibilities did that bring to you?
It brought quite a lot. We were in this, not only people who guided the tanks and sorted out routes, but we were a kind of general staff officer for our colonels. See, we were trained in the use of the compass and map reading, and singularly few people were able to do that. My CO couldn't read a map to save his life. And so we were very valuable in a technical sense. Another thing that we had as guidance in our battles were aeroplane photographs, not only taken direct from the up above, but oblique photographs. And so then sometimes they were extremely good, giving an exact picture, really, of what a tank commander would see when he crossed the starting point. And these had to be interpreted, because most of the chaps had held an aeroplane photograph upside down. They had the clue what it meant, what shadows meant, and so forth. And so one had a good deal of training to do there. Any other odd spare moments that I've told you, I used to go around collecting black market food for the mess.
Right. During the retreat in the tanks, you must have had a big problem with mechanical breakdowns. I mean, they only had 12-mile track life, you said.
Yes.
How did you keep track of where a tank had broken down? Just by endlessly sending the company and battalion yourself going round, seeing where all of them were?
That was the way the crew of the broken down tank itself would try and get in touch. You see, a battalion wouldn't be spread over a very great area, and it was difficult, but who could find it all right? There was one occasion, I regret to say, when some chap thought he was much nearer the German than he was, and he set his tank on fire and blew everything up and came along on foot, and 2 days later we had to go back and recover it. But the communications was a frightful problem, and that is where we reconnaissance officers came in for a good deal of riding about the country, trying to find not only our own tanks and give them a rallying point to make for, but also to try and get some direction from above as to what the hell we are going to do in the way of stopping the Germans at home.
Was there a problem with the speed of the tanks and being overtaken by the Germans, or were they able to keep up with the retreat? And did they not get, sort of side by side, did they not get in the way of other retreating units, because they would rather block a road up?
Oh, yes, to block the road completely, but then they had great advantages of being able to use the countryside on the other side of the road. And as far as speed is concerned, well, an advance, an infantry advance, is a very slow business. It may go at 4 or 5 miles an hour for 200 or 300 yards, and then they stop and reform. And it boils down to about a mile an hour at the best. The tank's top speed was 4 miles an hour, so that was racing.
Was there any problem with getting supplies, both for the crews and for the tank? I'm thinking of fuel during the retreat.
There was a certain amount of trouble, but we must remember that there were dumps which serviced the Army Service Corps lorries and other motor cars in the Army. Various dumps about the place on which one could draw. And in extreme cases, you had battalion transport, which was to send fuel up. See, in those days, fuel was not supplied in tankers. It went in 2-gallon cans. So you could use any method of transport for it.
How far did you retreat? You say you pulled back to Bois-Robert. About how far back was that in all?
I suppose it was about 6 miles.
And how long were you how long did it take you to cover that in all?
You mean the whole unit? It's impossible to say, because tanks were coming in all hours of the day and night, you see, and the next day, and the day after.
So it took quite a while to get the unit back
together.
Oh,
yes, it took quite a while to get the unit back.
What happened then?
Well, we were very comfortable there. We had tents to sleep in, made a rough hut to provide the Italian headquarters mess.
Did the battalion headquarters mess differ from the company mess as much?
No, just about the same numbers of people and about the same setup. My colonel was a great bon vivre, so one of my major tasks was to find something. Occasionally you could buy a lamb from a flock of sheep, somebody, one of the shepherds would wink an eye and sell you a lamb. And occasionally you could get back and get the cheeses and so on, eggs for further back areas.
What was your colonel's name? Do you remember?
Bryce, B-R-Y-C-E.
Do you have any other recollections of him? Stories that can illustrate his character?
No, I only know that he's a very brave chap. He only carried a revolver to shoot himself in case he was maimed. He was always in the thick of the battle, as near as it was sensible for him to be. He had no fear at all. And I think he was extremely patient with us, for callow and inexperienced young men, always doing the wrong thing and so on. I have no knowledge of his private life or anything like that. I believe he died in Paris sometime between the wars.
You got on well with him, though?
I got on very well with him. Oh, yes, rather. Got him because the map reading thing, probably. If he had to go anywhere, I had to go and direct him which way.
Were you involved at all in the main counterattacks after the retreat?
Do you mean local attacks, or do you mean...
Well, either, really. The local attacks, or the advance to victory, as it's known, so to speak.
Well, there was one local attack, I know, which was made with tanks and the Australians, and the odd reason for it was to show to the Australians that the tanks were extremely useful assault weapons. They'd had a very bad experience early on when, as usual, two or three tanks had been put in on the day of a snowstorm, and the Australians had got badly shot up because they relied on the tanks, and tanks didn't deliver the goods. There weren't enough of them, and they weren't supported in any way, so in the white snow they were easy targets. Anyway, this little battle, which is called Hamel, took place, and it was a complete success. I don't think we lost any tanks at all. The casualties were very, very small. And from then on, we were the diggers' bright-eyed boys.
Was your unit actually in this attack?
Yes, yes.
What do you remember about the planning and organisation of that?
I remember going to see the Australian general as my CO, and he made it quite clear that the tank's job is to go first and clear the way, which is what we always wanted. He agreed that they would do that. There wasn't a lot of organization to do. It was more or less understood pattern of work by then. But it's the only battle in which I had a dress circle seat, because the river scarp, that point, goes round a curve, and there's a high embankment on one side, very high embankment. I suppose it must be 150 feet. And this embankment was terraced by gun positions and signal points and all the rest of it. So we drove up in our staff car along the road at the bottom, got out of the car, climbed up one of these perpendicular faces and got a zigzag path, opened our picnic basket in which I had filled with sandwiches and champagne, and we sat there and watched the battle from there. And it was great fun. Of course, the usual smoke covers everything pretty well, but you could see it all right. And nobody fired at us at all, so it was a lovely party.
Had you had to lay the markers for the tanks for their start positions, or would the new company, the company?
The new company, reconnaissance officers would lay those down.
So you no longer had that responsibility?
No, I hadn't got that personal one. I had taken them out, of course, to show them the ground first, beforehand. So they did their own taping. The Australians got to know the tank tape quite well. It was a white tape with a black line down the middle, about an inch and a half wide. And we, in our camp in Warrawbear, we put a line of tank tape round our battalion headquarters, tents and mess, in order to stop vehicles and things driving through it in the dark. And we had some Australians who were nearby for a meal and drinks, and we had quite an uproarious party. And the next morning, dawn, we went out, and there were two chaps crawling along the ground. They said, "What on earth are you doing?" "We're following the tank tape, it'll take us home." And they were walking round and round the camp following this tape, and they had done since about 2 a.m. The poor chaps. We took them home.
After this Battle of Hamel, what was the next engagement you were in, or the next major event you can remember?
The next major event after the Battle of Hamel was the 8th of August 1918, which, as Ludendorff said, was the Black Day of the German Army. And it was another Cambrai battle over again, properly staged, no artillery bombardment beforehand, no dirt thrown up. We were just were adequately supported, and there was no trouble. My colonel and I and the sergeant major were walking down the main road behind the tanks, and there were, I don't think we saw a broken down tank during the whole time.
What part had you played in planning the battle, or had you played any part in planning it?
Well, we were reconnaissance officers. We were in a peculiar position. We were very often taken into confidence by higher authority and told things that our commanding officers didn't know. We had prior knowledge of what was going to go on. It was highly secret on the date of this battle, 8th of August, like all the rest. Highly, not a word was said to anybody, but we, the tank commanders, were told about it, and more or less laid down the pattern for where our units were going to go. It was pretty obvious anyway, but they didn't want it to get a chit-chat to get about, which it would have done.
Where exactly were you launching your part of the attack? It was in the... Is there any local village or any feature that would pinpoint it?
Yes. It was in front of the village of Villers Bretonneau that we mentioned before, and the battalion was on either side of the main road leading from Villers Bretonneau to I forget where, Bapaume, I think. Anyhow, it was one of the main French roads.
Did the tanks got through the barbed wire and over the lines as at Cambrai, did they?
Just the same, you see.
They used the anchors and then the fascines.
Well, the anchors were only used after the battle to clear the way for other troops to get through. They were really a sanitary squad, as you might say. You could walk through the barbed wire after the tanks on the track marks where the tanks left them, although there would be 6 to 8 inches or more of solid barbed wire under where the track had been. It shows how thick it was, and it was all flattened completely down, and you could walk on it like a road. But you couldn't take animals over it very well, and you couldn't take wheeled transport over it. So what they did was to get two tanks, they did it all on the front, two tanks together, go into the wire, drop their anchors, and drive away from each other. And the wire would roll out into an enormous ball, and clean the ground, clean as a whistle. Yeah, how they got the anchor out, I don't know. I don't think it probably never did.
So, you were following up behind. Did you come under fire at all during the attack?
Oh yes, we came under fire because we came on the front line German field guns, which were overrun at that time by the infantry, and we were about 50 yards in front of one of these field guns, and he was loosing off every round he could. I think it was a single gunner, very bravely hanging behind it, firing off every round that was left. Unfortunately, one of these shells burst and hit me, and it knocked my ankle about rather badly, and knocked pieces into me all over, and I couldn't go on, couldn't walk anymore, so that's the end of the war for me.
You'd seen enough, though, that you were confident before you got wounded that there was going to be no problem in the society.
Oh, it's obvious there's no problem.
You mentioned earlier that you were starting to have more problems with maintaining a brave front on it.
Yes.
How were you doing at this time, just before you were wounded? I mean, that last month of the war, Did your nerves show through in any way, or did you just control it?
Uncontrolled it. I could always tell somebody whose nerve was getting a bit ropey. Very often they would go and do something which was more dangerous than they need have done, just to reassure themselves. I mean, you have to walk through, there's a barrage going across the land that you've got to walk through. Well, you can sit and wait for half an hour until the barrage is finished, and the Germans have fed up, or it's time for tea, or you can take a chance and go through it. And very often, chap has lost his nerve, will defy himself and go on and go through it when he needn't do. That's the sort of thing I mean.
Did you find yourself doing that sort of thing?
No, like hell I didn't. I just lay down there and waited till it was over.
So you were wounded in the ankle by a shell, well, by shell fragments.
Yes.
How were you evacuated?
I was carried to the rear by four German prisoners who were delighted to do so. Carried to the nearest...
On a stretcher?
On a stretcher, yes. The nearest casualty clearing regimental aid post. It's the nearest regimental aid post. From there I was sent by ambulance to the casualty clearing station, further back still, and from there by train.
Did they treat you at all? Did they bandage it or sort it out at all?
Oh yes, they bandaged it and looked at it and said, ha ha. But unfortunately they didn't operate on it until I got back into London, which was 2 days later, and by that time gangrene had set in and I very nearly lost my foot. In fact, but for the kind offices of one of the sisters of the ward, I would have lost it, and she battled for me. But it's so painful having it dressed that they thought it'd be easier to take my foot off. But they didn't. I still got it, but look at the size of it. You see, it's all wrong.
Yes.
Enormous.
Now, you said before, when you got blighty wounds, or when you got your son done, that you didn't really want to go back to England. Were you now ready for a blighty wound, so to speak? Were you reasonably pleased to be out of it, or how did you feel about it?
I would not have liked to have left the regiment. I would like to have come back no matter what. I felt we were on the winning end of the war, and I'd like to have been in at that last bit. But when I was, after convalescing, I was posted back to our depot in Bovington, where I found a new battalion was being formed, consisting of skeleton staff from the old one, including my old CO. And
what had happened to your old battalion?
We were just carrying on, but they, you know, sneaked odds and ends away from it to form a new battalion at home, much of a skeleton to form it round. But it never happened. It was never formed. Then I'd.
Why wouldn't it form? Because of the end of the war.
It's the end of the war. Yes, they stopped forming anymore. In fact, started breaking up. What did exist?
How long had you, were you off with this wound then? You were wounded 8th of August. When did you go to the depot?
I think it would be sometime in December.
So it was after the armistice. How did you respond?
Oh yes, it was after the armistice.
How did you remember what you thought on Armistice Day? What were you part of? Did they have any celebrations where you were?
I have no knowledge whatever, I'm afraid. I have no knowledge what happened. Where I was in at that time.
You don't remember the
armistice. I don't remember the armistice.
Didn't make an impression.
No. I was probably on leave at home, I expect.
How How did you feel about the war being over, though? You may not remember the actual armistice day, but were you pleased? Or?
Oh, yes. Yes, I was pleased the war was over. And I emerged with practically a whole skin.
How did you feel about the positive and negative things it had done for you? Was it all bad or all good, or what had it done for you?
Well, I was too young to assess the effect it had on my character. One thing it did, I must say, naturally enough, was to speed up the development of my character very considerably, because from a very early age I was obliged to take on tremendous responsibilities. And I think that's a very good thing for a young chap. And of course I made the usual stupid mistakes. But I decided in view of having been able to find myself amongst other men, that I'd like to go on with that sort of life.